Hi, this is Linda Holmes. I'm the host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm here in Studio 44 with Stephen Thompson from NPR Music. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Well, Stephen and I are here to introduce this week's episode, which is a very special one for us. You may recall that a few weeks ago we were scheduled to do our Oscars show live in the studio, and then, well,
then some sort of snow hit.
Yeah.
And this brought the city to its knees.
It was winter. The city was brought to its knees and we had to cancel. But this week we got to make up this show. So what you will hear is our live discussion with our good pal Guy Raz.
Yeah, we decided not to do another Oscars omnibus just because we had promised to do one in our last live show.
We figured it would be
would have been confusing. I had some ace material about Whiplash all lined up.
We figured it would be a little bit out of season. But so that's the show that you're going to hear today. We want to thank everybody who was involved in helping us make that show. Guy, of course, Eric Newsom and Izzy Smith and Anna Seebach here at NPR, Justin Wynn and Joe Hagan, who did our ticketing and front of house stuff, Neil Tivalt and Andrew Huther, who are our engineers. We had a great time. We had a great show. The wonderful audience that showed up, of course. So that's what this week's show will be. And we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, you will hear that show.
Thanks to our sponsor, Loot Crate. It's a monthly subscription box service for epic geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. Each month, Loot Crate will send you a box with 6 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, and unique one-of-a-kind items. March's covert-themed Loot Crate will include items from your favorite spy and thriller themes and franchises. But you only have until March 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe. Head to lootcrate.com/NPR and enter code NPR to save 10% on any new subscription.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. When does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, live at NPR headquarters in Washington, we'll talk about cultural anniversaries. Whether you're marking 5 years, 50 years, or even 500 years, we'll try to figure out what we learn from them, how often it makes sense to return to them, and what's the best way to keep our own nostalgia in check. And from things turning 25 to things turning 5, we'll talk about the kids' entertainment that we still find satisfying as adults and whether that's part of what helps it stand the test of time. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week before we get started here in historic Studio One. Stephen Thompson. What do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Guy Raz. What do you do at NPR, Guy Raz?
I host the TED Radio Hour.
And Glenn Weldon. Glenn, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Now, we will get to our main topics in just a minute, but first I want to ask those of you who are here with us in the studio to do me a favor, and that is to help introduce all of you. Now that we've introduced all of these people, we're going to introduce all of you to the many people who are listening to the show at home. So here's what we're going to do. When I point to you, you're going to say, "Oh, hi." So here we go. You ready? To all of you listening to this show in your car.
Oh, hi.
To those of you doing the dishes or doing the laundry.
Oh, hi.
To those of you who are at the gym.
Oh, hi.
To those of you taking a walk.
Oh, hi.
To those of you who are in Ohio.
Oh, hi.
And to all of the rest of you who are taking the time to listen.
Oh, hi.
That's wonderful.
Nicely done.
So welcome to all.
Now we expect complete silence.
Reverent silence.
An odd hush, if you will.
An odd hush. So we came upon our first topic when Guy pointed out to us that 2015 is the 30th anniversary of a very impressive slate of movies that came out in 1985. Guy, do you want to talk a little bit about this and why it's freaking you out?
So it starts with Back to the Future, which,
it does.
If you remember, came out in 1985. And Back to the Future was about 1955. So it was a film about what had happened 30 years before. So we are the same distance from Back to the Future today as Back to the Future was from 1955. And I started to think about that, and it really freaked me out.
You just blew my mind.
Right? So, like, when I was listening to Like a Virgin or, like, Chaka Khan or to, you know, Careless Whisper, that was our distance from that point to like, Bill Haley and the Comets, Rock Around the Clock. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Like a Virgin to today, to 10-year-old today, was like, you know, listening to that or, like, Mr. Sandman and hearing that in 1985. Like, that was so old. So it just got me thinking, like, it sort of gives you a perspective on time and your sense of distance from things. And I remember when I came to NPR in 1997 as a wee lad, and every week there was a different baby boomer anniversary. It was like, oh, Janis Joplin reissue, or 25 years of Woodstock, or 25 years of Watergate. And now I think that because Gen Xers are starting to make decisions, you know, and are becoming like...
And we hate baby boomers.
Yeah. And they're becoming like a culturally dominant generation. Right. I think that's why we're starting to notice things like, you know, John Hughes movies, or like, you know, 25 years since Nirvana, or, you know, Jesus Jones tearing down the Berlin Wall, or, you know, like whatever.
The band.
They didn't do it. But the video.
It was its primary accomplishment. Right here, right now, tearing down the Berlin Wall.
It was David Hasselhoff who did it. But... So then you sort of start to wonder whether these anniversaries really are relevant, right?
Well, and here's my question to you about the thing that you raised about Bill Haley in the Comets. Let me get back to your Bill Haley in the Comets.
Yes.
It seems to me there are two ways to think about that, right? One way is to think this 10-year-old is the same distance from the music that I liked as a teenager as I was from Bill Haley in the Comets. Therefore, I'm really old, which is kind of the most, like, that's the most tweetable, most common kind of look at me, I feel so old.
Right.
But the other way is to say, like, my parents were not as old as I thought they were when I was a kid. Like, Bill Haley in the Comets was not as old as I thought it was. Yeah. Like, I thought it was from a completely different era, but it's unavoidable. Everybody is a cultural narcissist up to a point and measures time by their own life and by the amount of stuff that they personally have been exposed to.
Do you think? I was speaking to a friend of mine recently who's in his 70s, and he was saying that for most of your 30s to your, you know, mid-60s even, he said in his mind, he was the same age, basically, right? If that makes sense?
No, it does.
And so he just thought of himself as just kind of fixed.
For me, that's like eight.
Like eight, right? And then something happens where that changes.
Right. Until I break a hip, I'm eight.
Yep. Right? Yeah, I mean, we had a party for my wife's 40th birthday recently. And so what happens when a bunch of early middle-aged people hang out is that at 10 p.m. the after party starts.
and the rave
begins. Because other people are like leaving to like relieve the babysitter, and so the karaoke machine came out. And so some people were singing, like, you know, New Order or The Smiths, you know, DeBarge.
Thank you.
And
we only listen to The Smiths, maybe a little Joy Division.
Yeah, right?
You know, and DeBarge.
And DeBarge. That would be like karaoke 30 years ago doing Chubby Checker and Elvis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're not wrong.
Like OMD and Depeche Mode and DeBarge is like Chubby Checker and Elvis.
Well, see, you guys have kids. So for those of us who don't, these anniversaries are like birthdays. They are milestones on our road to the grave. They're the way that we chart our decrepitude and our senescence. And it's useful to make a distinction between, like, the 50th anniversary of, like, Selma, you know, an event that shaped the course of human events, and, you know, the 30th anniversary of the very special episode of Punky Brewster where Cherry gets locked in the refrigerator,
I remember this.
Which is coming up on January 9th, 2016. There will be a Vox think piece about it. Gird your loins now.
Yeah.
But they're just news pegs. They're just ways for media outlets to churn out content. And every time I find out the one's coming up, I'm like, ugh. But then last year, the 30th anniversary of Clue presaged a bunch of oral histories. And I was like, I am in. So it is cultural narcissism. Exactly your point.
Right. That's the value of it. The value of it is if it just serves as a reason to revisit something where the world that we live in has so much cultural commentary, so much cultural commentary, but requires an excuse to talk about anything that isn't happening right this second. So, I mean, I wrote a piece a couple years ago that was about the fact that 25 years previous to that, both Baby Boom and Fatal Attraction had been in movie theaters at the same time, which is a really interesting time to way to kind of talk about images of working women and stuff like that. But I don't really care that it was 25 years. Right. It's just that as a writer, you feel like, well, I can't just be like, let me tell you about these two old movies that
right.
I'm totally fascinated by. You have to have some reason okay. to say, like, I feel moved, you know. I feel moved by, like, for example, one of the things that Guy mentioned is the upcoming 30th anniversary of Fletch, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Like, let's have a little bit of think piece action yeah. regarding Fletch.
And European Vacation.
And European Vacation.
Same year.
Yeah. It's yeah. like the Chevy Chase golden age.
It's a golden era.
But seriously.
The entertainment PR industry would not exist without 25th anniversary.
Half of the publicists who send me emails
exactly.
would not
well,
exist without it.
Grind to a halt.
And half of our meetings discussing news stories
right.
wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I mean, not to get too inside baseball about this stuff, but you run the risk in a lot of meetings where we sit around pitching stories, not so much on this show because we're noble, but you know, I'm on the NPR music team, and we recently had a number of Nirvana related milestones. You had the 20th anniversary of In Utero, and there was a gigantic In Utero box set, and we were managing this flood of Nirvana pieces about In Utero, and at one point, I mean, you hate to be ghoulish about it, but at some point you kind of have to stand on the table and say, Kurt Cobain died 20 years ago in 2 months.
Yeah.
So what you really want to watch out for with a lot of these things that are moving targets, you get into the habit of eternally recycling these same discussions because there's always an anniversary. And
right.
and the fact that it's 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, 35, and at some point are we going to talk about the 35th anniversary of In Utero and then the 30th anniversary of Kurt Cobain's
but,
death?
But that's,
you then never
right.
talk, you never stop talking about the past.
But that's what I mean when I say the troubling thing about anniversaries and the troubling thing about using them as a peg to talk about things is that they come along every 5 years.
Right.
So
yeah.
you can theoretically, I mean, if you feel like upon the 30th anniversary of whatever movie from 1985, you suddenly have the great idea of the thing that you want to say about that thing, it's very likely that someone wrote it 5 years ago and it was the 25th anniversary
right.
of the exact same thing. So it's like at some point it becomes very difficult to start to wean yourself off of constant anniversaryizing. And one of the things I said to Guy when he and I were talking about this is, you know, the big anniversaries that people make the biggest fuss over tend to be maybe the 10th as an early one, but then the 25th and the 50th. And to me, I like 30th as an anniversary because we have talked before on this show about the theory that the things that are most indelible for you culturally are the things that you become interested in when you're like 13 or 14. And with those things, the 25th anniversary of those things comes when you're in your late 30s. And when you're in your late 30s, you're not quite yet at that point where you're really starting to think, what is my relationship to popular culture? A lot of people still feel like very current at that point. But by the 30th,
they haven't yet teetered over the brink into the abyss.
I mean, I don't mean it that way. I tend to find that a very boring thing when I get into that. I try not to be that person. But I think by the time you're over 40, you really are thinking differently about your relationship to the culture. And if you are still really involved in it, you start to feel a little bit, is it weird that I still kind of listen to a lot of popular music? Is it weird that I still go to a lot of like popular movies? And so I like the 30th because that's how you catch that person who is 13 or 14 when they're 43 or 44, which I think is a really interesting moment to kind of think about the age of the stuff that you love.
I think the most interesting anniversaries and the anniversaries that resonate the most as like radio pieces, again, inside baseball, are the anniversaries that represent pivot points. And, you know, you mentioned Selma as a historical one. It allows you to take stock and see how far we've come, how far we haven't come. And I think cultural pivot points are very interesting. They're, when you talk about, in a way, some of the 1985 milestones have a certain element of pivot to them. Where I find them less engaging and more problematic is when you talk about things like the 10th anniversary of Transatlanticism by the band Death Cab for Cutie. Transatlanticism came out in 2003 and really soundtracked a lot of people's coming of age, and it's a kind of a coming of age record. But it came out 10 years ago. And Death Cab for Cutie is an ongoing concern. And that record
right.
like lived for several years. It was on the soundtrack to everything.
But that's
every time like somebody missed somebody on a TV show. for like 4 years, you heard that song. And so do you need to stop and reflect on like 10 years of transatlanticism?
You don't. I
mean, I still wrote about it.
But you're also partly responding to that fact that, like, to you, 10 years is like 10 years.
It's a blip on the radar. It's nothing. Yeah.
I don't think it has to be like you only think that because you're so old, or young people only think that because they're so young, or any. I mean, like I said, I find those kind of boring ways to think about it. It's another one of those situations where anytime you're trying to get at an anniversary, like a 10th anniversary is a great example. To some people, that really feels like we are just at the beginning of thinking back upon this thing as opposed to being in it. And to other people, that feels like, you know, wow, that's 10 years. That was a long time ago. And it partly depends on how many life phases you've passed through since then. Because if you are 25 now and you were 15 then,
you're two different people.
Your life has changed a lot in those 10 years since transatlanticism, and it's highly likely. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're us, it's very possible that you wind up much closer. You haven't seen as many changes in your own life. Mm-hmm. Since that time. How do you feel about 1985, Glenn?
Oh, God. 1985 was when I was just beginning to become pretentious, really perfecting it. And so I was starting to pull away from mainstream films and spending a lot of time at the Ritz Five in Philadelphia watching Letter to Brezhnev, which is this joyless British film about women who write a letter to Brezhnev. And it's just, you know, all set in Liverpool and it's depressing. And I thought, this is brilliant. And I didn't actually go to see Back to the Future because I thought it was too mainstream.
You didn't see Back to the Future in a theater.
Nope. Well, you are in for a treat.
Yeah.
You are.
When I did see it, it seemed kind of Disney and, you know, sign up broad. And, this is not a popular
opinion.
I understand that.
It seemed kind of Disney compared to my Letter to Brezhnev movie. I don't know. Have you aired your id about 1985, Guy? Or is it still going to haunt you?
I do think that really what it comes down to is it's that the people who sort of make decisions about what matters are the people who are moved by these things.
But that's a really interesting point you raise about Linda's 30-year idea, is that a lot of the decision makers in entertainment are like 43 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've managed to reach the age that we have and become much more successful. And then they're making all of the decisions. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, but you've made that point before.
When they're obsolete, like all we'll go down with them.
No. The point I'm making is you've said that before, though, that there are times when you are kind of watching television or listening to commercials and saying, hey, you know what? The people who are now in charge of all of this television and all of these ads and all of this cultural stuff are people who are of my cohort and like the same things.
To have stolen my iPod.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's true. It's true.
And in 10 years, 15 years, we'll get iCarly the movie, The Sweet Life and Jack and Cody, Zach and Cody.
Miniseries.
You are really close. Surprisingly close. Yeah. Sweet Life of Zach and Cody.
You were in with the young people and then just outside your grasp.
Crumbled to dust.
Well, you did turn your back on them when you were like 15.
<There is that.
laughs> All right. Well, so I would be curious to hear what people think about this issue of anniversaries and cultural celebrations. And I would particularly be interested in hearing about whether there are kinds of marks that people put on that kind of stuff that you do find meaningful and that you do find interesting. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org or tweet us at NPRPCHH and tell us what you think. So we are going to shift gears slightly, but not entirely, for our other topic today, which is stuff for kids, which has stood the test of time, either as we pass from childhood to adulthood or down through generations now. We love to talk about kids' stuff with Guy. Because as he explained the first time that he was on the show, this is what he gets to see.
That's it. Yeah.
He gets to see things for kids.
Yeah. Like, my big thing now is Cinderella coming out. Like, my 6-year-old and 4-year-old, we're going to go see that. Like, the films I've seen in the last 5 months, Big Hero 6, you know, Penguins of Madagascar, SpongeBob the Movie, Paddington... You know, so I've seen...
You're a connoisseur. You're a connoisseur of a very specific thing.
Right? Yeah. So, but I think the sort of the weirdest thing about this is that you just never know what's going to stand the test of time, right? Like, I've noticed that there's a whole My Little Pony thing that's been going on, right?
There is.
Right? So, but...
That is knowing laughter. That sound right there.
But I was thinking like about the My Little Pony thing, because why that and not Strawberry Shortcake, for example?
No, right? I agree.
You know, like,
I agree.
You know, she was interesting. Her hair smelled like strawberries. And, you know, and it's the same reason why there seems to be like a lot of nostalgia.
I don't know the origins of that. That's a great question.
Right?
But I think the fact that one is called My Little Pony, it's just a funnier, goofier, kind of more cloying.
Funnier than a Strawberry Shortcake? Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Strawberry Shortcake is just food.
Right. Okay, yeah. So Rainbow Bright. Where does Rainbow Bright
fit? Yeah, Rainbow Bright has a little more.
Why is there not a Rainbow Bright cult like there is a My Little Pony cult?
Exactly. But I think some of it comes down to incredibly boring issues of licensing.
It does sort of raise the question of why some things are not others, right? Like, you wouldn't, like, there's a whole sort of Saved by the Bell thing, but not Kids Incorporated. What happened?
And more's the pity.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about what are the things that my kids like, and how would that translate into what might be interesting or appealing in the future? And actually, I think there might be a little bit of a pattern. I think the things that Ten Steps of Time have, like a narrative arc, you got the hero's journey, really good writing, compelling characters. So Princess Bride, right? Like, when it came out, who thought, you didn't immediately think that was going to be what it became, but it did. And in 25 years from now, that movie is still going to be great, you know? And I think you can say the same thing about Harry Potter, you know, at least the books.
But everything you're naming is a freestanding world that is not trying to capture the zeitgeist of the particular moment.
Yeah. Right.
The fact that they were engineered to be timeless, or something like A Christmas Story that is set in a very specific kind of quaint past.
Yeah.
And so you don't have what Glenn and I talk about a lot, which is the problem of you to Ant.
Right.
Which, if we've never explained this before.
Yeah, we should probably explain it. There was a movie called Ant in like 1997. And there's
DreamWorks, right?
Ants with a Z, it's DreamWorks. And there was a Sylvester Stallone ant, he's come up again. And at one point he goes, "You da ant."
Yep.
And it immediately just cast that movie in amber for 1997. Yes. And it could never be a movie.
And it's not simply that it's a reference that's dated, that instantly dates. It's the difference between sincerity and cynicism. When you hear something like that, you hear the focus group. You hear you hear that it was done by committee, that it was targeted. There was a pitch meeting and people were pitching jokes.
Well, and you hear,
let's punch it up, let's punch it up.
And you hear people like us saying, you know, my kid says this
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Be hilarious right here. My kid walks around all the time. You to man, you to man. Let's have him say you to aunt.
Exactly.
And?
Sincerity is a big thing. I also wrote down surprise. Now, Guy, you've been saying that Frozen is going to stand the test of time.
Frozen will stand the test of time.
Okay. When we were kids, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Willy Wonka, Sound of Music, Wizard of Oz came on once a year.
Yeah.
They were events. You gathered around the television. It was a Sunday night. It was a thing. And, you know, memory and good feelings happen when you have intense emotions around a thing. And the fact that these things happen once a year meant that there was intense emotions around them. Now you've got Frozen on the background 24/7. It's like, kids are experiencing it like we experience Rocky Horror. It's just this noise.
But I'm gonna counter that by saying that maybe Frozen is the equivalent, to go back almost 30 years, New Kids on the Block.
Uh-huh.
That New Kids on the Block were on the wind in the late 80s.
They were new
at the time, and they were kids at the time. And it was like the late 80s and early 90s, and they were absolutely inescapable. And kids didn't listen to New Kids on the Block once a year. They were absolutely immersed in them and as an obsession, and part of their childhood identity is rooted in, I was that one who had Jordan Knight poster. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was super cool. I listened to Chicago. And so Frozen may kind of be the Jordan Knight, where you can trot out Frozen on Ice the way you trot out a New Kids on the Block tour as a nostalgia event now. And I think that is going to get lodged in the firmament the way so many of these timeless things do, where the generations get knotted together and parents sharing them with their children, sharing them with their children's children, sharing them, etc.
Right. But I don't think Frozen is just a one-season Halloween costume. Like, I think it's got... there's an appeal about it, and I think that there is something more enduring about it. I don't quite know exactly what that is. It may be that Anna is an interesting princess. Elsa is a really strong queen. You've got Olaf, who speaks on multiple... I know a lot about this movie.
It's funny funny because I was going to jump in, and then I just realized that Guy filibustering on Frozen is my new favorite thing.
Yeah, I have seen this movie many times.
But I brought up the notion of pivot points before, and I think you could argue that Frozen was a little bit of a pivot point in the way women and girls were portrayed in animated movies, and I think you're going to see more and more of an emphasis on that, where you have animators waking up to, oh, we have to put, what was it that Lord and Miller said, like, we have to put female stuff in the next Lego movie, where, you know, where I think that in that way, Frozen becomes a pivot point in the way these movies operate. Yeah. First of all, just because everybody wants to mimic its success.
Yeah.
The things I wrote down were sincerity, surprise, simplicity, songs. One of the things that unites Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Willy Wonka, Sound of Music, Wizard of Oz is not just that they were once annual events, it's also like they have good tunes.
They are,
does Frozen. And you know, I mean, there's certain music that you can't hear anymore because it's just ubiquitous. But, I mean, there's a power to it. It's a big, brassy show tune that you just can't get enough of.
So Guy mentioned earlier Cinderella, and by the time this podcast is dropping on Friday, either we'll have just published or we'll be about to publish a very long thing that I'm working on about Cinderella, not the movie coming out this Friday, which I haven't seen yet, but the whole idea of the cultural Cinderella, who dates back hundreds and hundreds and arguably thousands of years in various forms. And by the way, everybody will tell you, there are really dark versions in the Brothers Grimm one, the birds peck out the stepsister's eyes. That is nothing. That is nothing compared to some of the weird goofball stuff that goes on. And I read a book called 345 Cinderella Variants. There is one that starts, and I'm not lying, woman gives birth to gourd. G-O-U-R-D, woman gives birth to gourd. And the only thing I will tell you about that.
I was going to say, it's instead of Gordon Lightfoot.
And I will say, the thing you should know about the one where the woman gives birth to the gourd, and the gourd contains the heroine of the story. It's an Italian one, variation. And the heroine's name, I swear to you, is Zucchettina. And the reason that I bring that up is that one of the things I said to Guy, first of all, it's awesome.
Yeah, that's A.
But as I said to Guy, it's amazing to think that like these things like Frozen or whatever, but Frozen specifically, right, as a princess story, Frozen specifically is competing not only with Tangled and people's love of The Little Mermaid and people's love of Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast, but like is also competing with stuff that has been around. And there is a folk tale on which Frozen is loosely based, but it's whatever. Whereas Cinderella, that is a story that comes back and back and back and back and back. And the one that is kind of the most familiar U.S. version dates back to the 17th century in France. And there is later after that, there's the Grimm version. There's obviously it's a Stephen Sondheim thing. It's a if you're trying to make kids entertainment that's going to last throughout the ages, you're competing with stuff that's already won with kids for thousands of years in some cases, particularly trying to add to the canon of princess stories. I mean, at this point, if I'm an executive, my second reason not to do princess stories is feminism. My first reason, well, not if I'm an executive. If I'm a storyteller, that's my second reason. My first reason is there's already a billion.
Yeah.
Why try to compete with that racket?
The only argument that I would make for continually re-updating is you do have the advantage of you are making the thing in the here and now, and you can take advantage of what modern movie pacing is. One of the interesting things about trying to show my kids movies from the 70s and 80s that I enjoy is they tend to be paced really differently. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with my kids over the weekend to watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And I thought, oh, it's so good. And then you watch it. First of all, the special effects are roughly equivalent to Goosebumps. Second of all, that movie gets pretty slack in its second half. Third of all, feminism. And so it doesn't necessarily have the same crackle and the same appeal. It has about 8 really good jokes that the kids dutifully laughed at, even when I wasn't looking. And so when you're making your umpty billionth princess movie, you at least get to interact with children's attention spans as they are currently perceived.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And very briefly, so superheroes are children's characters. Now, that is a controversial assertion in some areas of the world. People who use the word...
Pow, zap, etc.
Exactly. People use the word mythopoetic kind of really rebel against the notion that, that superheroes are children's characters because there are modern myths. Which, sure, yeah. But they were written for kids. That's why they have these huge imaginative things, and that's why everything is divided up into such a neat binary. Good, evil, light, dark. Good guys, bad guys. Law and order, crime and punishment. It's simple. That's the thing that makes them eternal. And what happened with superheroes is that as the kids who loved them grew up, they decided they wanted to take them with them into adolescence and adulthood. And one of the things that that simplicity gives you is repetition, kind of like what you're talking about with Cinderella. Repetition. We see it over and over again. So then they just said, well, let's add some complicating layers. And you get further and further from the pure thing that inspired it, and you get into this sort of joyless superhero world where we often find ourselves now in certain films and in a lot of comics. It's just what I've called before vivisecting the unicorn, where it can either, you take this beautiful, joyful thing and you feel like you must explain it.
Yeah.
Nobody cares why Superman flies. He flies. It's part of the deal. And in 1978, there was a Superman comic where they decided they needed to explain, and this story was inspired by a fan, go figure, why Superman can fool people just by putting on glasses. And turns out he is using his super hypnotism unconsciously, and it's magnified by the glasses, because his eyeglasses are made from the plexiglass, the Kryptonian plexiglass, that are in the windshield of his rocket that...
You are lying.
Not.
With frames by Warby Parker.
With frames by Warby Parker. This is a question that nobody, no fan ever asked, no kid ever asked, stand-up comics asked. They were like, so, let me get this straight. You know, right. And if that's the impulse behind your storytelling, you are going down the wrong path. Simplicity is another thing that I think is a through line through all this stuff. The reason things hold up is because there's a clear, unambiguous simplicity at the heart of them.
Hmm. What are you finding with your kids, Stephen, that they still... Is there stuff that they liked when they were much younger that they still care about?
They're not necessarily feeling terribly nostalgic yet. They're kind of moving into new binge watching. It kind of remains to be seen if they're going to go back and revisit SpongeBob, for example, which was a show that all three of us watched together and kind of enjoyed on exactly the same intellectual level.
You're right, no, sure.
You know? So sure. I don't think that there's necessarily, in part because the kids and I just kind of shared a lot of the same stuff. They watched a ton of The Simpsons. They watched a ton of Futurama. You know, SpongeBob
is... Yes, they did.
SpongeBob is funny enough that any adults around were not complaining about it. So it's a little early to tell. I mean, they've completely abandoned the iCarly, The Suite Life of Zack and Cody. It's a little early to tell in terms of nostalgia.
Yeah. How about your kids?
Yeah, I mean...
Your kids are younger than
They're younger, yeah. I mean, the Pixar movies are, I think, there's something about them that, you know, one after another, whether it's Up or Toy Story, The Incredibles or Nemo, this summer Inside Out is coming out. I mean, they are really effective at creating movies that have wide and deep appeal. I think Despicable Me as well. It's a film that's a family favorite, in Madagascar, too. I'm always curious about the things, though, that they just don't connect with. It's hard to know. I mean, you know, they loved Paddington. It's hard to imagine that that film will be viewed in 25 years, but it was actually a pretty good movie. And if you saw the trailer of that film, you would have never would have gone to see it. Like, the person who made...
Wasn't there... It was like a lot of, like, farting in the bathtub.
It was terrible. It was like farting in the bathtub, and it was just like... And, you know, earwax, and it was the dumbest. And whoever made the trailer, just it was a big fail. Because the film was great, and it had a bunch of actors from Mike Lee films. You know, it had Jim Broadbent and all these, like, amazing actors, Hugh Bonneville, and it was actually a great film.
And again, that's an old, old story.
It's an old
story. You know, Paddington, again, is an old, old story. Not as old as Cinderella, I don't think, but certainly an old story.
Yeah, and superheroes as well. I mean, Spider-Man, right? And Spider-Man, like... Like, we all wore Spider-Man underwear, and my
Speak
children...
Speak for yourself. Yeah,
thankfully, I don't have to recycle my old ones.
Right.
They don't have them, but my boys wore them too, and...
Just passed them down.
I just passed them down from generation to generation.
Now you are a man.
Be like a cedar chest.
Yes.
No, open it up.
Here's my Spider-Man underwear.
It'd be like a family documents, and then... Spider-Man.
But he's
the equivalent of handing down like a family quilt.
Yes. I mean, he's an appealing character, right? Because he's like this sort of kid who's picked on and bullied. And what's amazing is I thought immediately of Peter Parker when I saw Big Hero 6. Because Hiro Hamada is the same kind of kid
yeah.
who becomes a superhero,
yeah.
right? It's the same archetype.
Exactly.
Well, I think it will be interesting in time to see what Steven's kids are interested in a few years and what Guy's kids are interested in a few years. Glenn and I will not have to worry about it.
Yep.
That's cool. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Steven Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Well, this, of course. Thank you all. Lovely, lovely people. For being here. By the time this episode drops, I will be preparing to fly down to Austin for South by Southwest. And nope, not going to mention it. I am not going to mention a certain number between, say, 99 and 101.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many of you are going to South by Southwest here in this room, but for those listening at home, if you go to South by Southwest and see me, please don't be shy. Please do say hello. It's always a wonderful experience. I just love being among people who are incredibly earnestly excited about music. It's always exhausting, but incredibly invigorating. I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the fact that so many of you came out even though we are currently missing the Bachelor finale.
It's true. It's very sad.
Who is that chunk of wood gonna pick? Who knows? Though it is not making me happy at all, the passing of Sam Simon, one of the great minds behind the early years of The Simpsons, and as a result, a godzillionaire who basically took all his money and gave it away, was a very, very fascinating character with an incredible story, and I highly recommend this wonderful piece by Meryl Marco in Vanity Fair near the end of Sam Simon's life, talking to him extensively, talking to his people, talking about what inspired him and how much it inspired him. It's a beautiful remembrance, and you know, it's always tricky to talk about the people whose work we loved so much when they die as part of what's making us happy, but I did want to acknowledge that incredibly, incredibly sad passing, but also just an opportunity, like anniversaries, it's an opportunity to be freshly inspired by someone's work. And finally, just watched season 7 of Parks and Rec and sobbed like a baby, as is my wont. That show, I'm not to give anything away for those who are behind on it, but that show really shares my obsession with making nice things happen for these people. And so I found it a very satisfying conclusion to a show that has enriched my life in wonderful ways.
Thank you very much, Steven Thompson. Guy Raz, what is making you happy this week, bud?
So I discovered something called Dub Smash, which has become a game changer in my household. This is an app that allows you to video yourself lip syncing to 10 seconds of any pop song or a line from a film. And then you can message it to anybody you know.
The people at home did not see or hear Glenn's shudder.
It's true. Glenn's full body shudder.
Yeah. Yeah, when he saw me and my boys lip syncing to Gangnam Style.
Mm-hmm. The Yuta Ant of about 3 years ago.
Right, and Can't Touch This, and Lions from the Godfather, and Frozen. Mm-hmm. It is an amazing...
Who Let the Dogs Out?
Who Let the Dogs Out?
There's never been a better time.
Muzzle top.
In fact, I have a friend, actually, who's my neighbor. We now communicate exclusively... by text using Dub Smash.
I'm gonna give you Glenn's number later. Ah.
And that is making me very, very happy. Yeah.
That is wonderful. Thank you very much, Guy Raz. Glenn, other than the fact that now you're gonna get a lot of videos of Guy singing Who Let the Dogs Out, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. First is, over the weekend, it was made clear to me by gay Twitter that if I did not watch The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix, they would come over and break my thumbs. They would do so with verve and elan, but they would break my damn thumbs.
Sure.
Gay Twitter is right, people. Not about everything, but about this. It stars Ellie Kemper from The Office playing a survivor of an apocalypse cult who's been captive for 15 years and is now free to make it in the big city. If you're a fan of jokes and joke density, this is a show for you. And also, as good as the writing is, and it's pretty great, the best moments of the show are Ellie Kemper reaction shots. She is great. She didn't have much to do on The Office. She played a very specific role in The Office. Here, she's given a lot more to do. It's fantastic. So that's A. B is a new memoir called H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald. Now, this book has been, you know, all over the place. It's not, I'm not telling you any secret. It was on the cover of the New York Times Book Review. It's getting huge, great reviews everywhere, deservedly so. It's about a Cambridge professor who is an expert in falconry who trains a hawk, a goshawk, in fact, while she's dealing with the death of her father. So it's a history of falconry. It's about the process behind falconry. If you were a process nerd, this is a book for you. It's about grief. It's about the history of England. It's
falconry about... and grief?
I know. It's about T.H. White. She parallels, you know, her experience with T.H. White, who also trained hawks and falcons and things. But it's mostly about the natural world. And there is a quality of attention to this writing. There's a fierce attention to just language that about the natural world that is just clear and rigorous, and it's just these observations that, like it's the year 2015, we should not be able to read a description of the color of a cloudy sky and have never seen it before, but she does it page after page after page. It is just, it's not showy writing, right? It's very clear, but it's just beautiful. Now, a lot of the connections she makes between grief and falconry, sometimes some of them work, sometimes they don't, but you never want to not be reading this book. It just makes you want to stay in it, in that world. It's H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Making me happy this week, a little bit of a creepy choice. There is an HBO documentary series running right now called The Jinx. And The Jinx is about a man who has been accused of being involved in several killings of people. Over time, he comes from an extremely wealthy New York family. If you saw the movie, or know of the movie, more likely know of the movie, All Good Things with Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst, it's based sort of on the life of this guy. And his wife was killed. His wife disappeared many years ago in the early 80s. And then another woman that he knew was killed. And then he admitted to killing a neighbor, chopping up his body, and dumping it in the ocean, and then he pleaded self-defense. The thing that makes this documentary completely fascinating is that although it's this incredibly grisly story, what can happen a lot of times in true crime stories is that it gets very wrapped up in kind of the actual committing of the crime, which is not really what this is about. And it's not really about the binary. Like, if you looked at people's reaction to Serial, had a lot to do with this binary of yes or no. You're always trying to find where you are in this line between do you believe the person did it or not. This is a series that is more about other issues that get raised in crimes besides whether a person did it or not. If you ask yourself whether anyone except an extremely wealthy, high-status person would be likely to be able to make the kind of plea that he made in the case with the neighbor, if you ask yourself what kind of resources he had, and then if you just look at all the aspects of this story, it's completely fascinating, and it does not fall into just that idea of like you're trying to figure out what the guy did and didn't do. At the same time, it has that sort of fascinating, unfolding cast of characters that if you do like true crime, if you did like Serial, I think it is a good choice for people who like their true crime stuff. Really creepy, but really well done. It's done by Andrew Jarecki, who made Capturing the Freedmans, and it's a really, really good doc, and I like the idea of HBO, which has done so many really highly regarded fictional series, experimenting with this six-part documentary series. It's completely engrossing to me, and it is wrapping up its season. When this podcast drops, for those of you at home, it will be Friday, and the series is wrapping up on Sunday. But if you've got HBO, then through whatever on-demand experience is available to you. I'm sure they have all six parts, and it's great. It's really, really good, and as creepy as it is kind of what's making me happy this week. And before we go, we should mention that the week after this podcast is the one that we mentioned earlier. We are reading the Nick Hornby book, Funny Girl. And we will be talking about it on the show. So if you want the best possible lead time, well, best possible lead time, get in your time machine and go back a few weeks. But there is a week to read the Nick Hornby book and catch up with us, and we will be here next week to do that. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Guy at Guy Raz. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica _ Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. You can follow the show itself at NPR PCHH. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which normally you are tapping your foot to at this point in the show. So thanks to all of you guys for being here at the table with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to all of you guys for being here in the audience with us. And to you at home who are not here in the audience with us, we appreciate you being there too, doing whatever it is that you are doing, and we are excited to see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. When does learning begin? Are we at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts.